Of the Moscow Stretensky Monastery Choir in Florida with a program of rare Russian sacred chants, popular folk songs, and 20th century romances. Having performed at the Vatican and Notre Dame de Paris, the choir is coming to the Adrian Arsht Center on Wednesday, October 17th at 8 p.m. The New York Times describes their sound as a luminous blend characteristic of Russian choral tradition. Tickets at arshtcenter.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper here, along with Bonnie Berman. How are you today, Bonnie?
I'm good, and how are you?
Well, we have a very good program.
We do.
Today we're discussing mammograms as well as breast reconstruction. And joining us from Atlanta is Dr. Handel Reynolds of Piedmont Hospital. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Welcome to you, Dr. Handel Reynolds. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Joseph. Thanks for having me on your show.
Also joining us in studio is Dr. Roger Khoury. He heads the Miami Breast Center in South Florida. He's a plastic surgeon and is an expert on post-mastectomy breast reconstruction. And welcome to you, Dr. Roger Khoury.
Thank you. Thanks for joining
the
program, too.
Dr. Reynolds, what prompted this book, and what's the political side to mammograms?
So your audience, Joseph, is probably quite familiar with the fact that in 2009, in November of that year, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force came out with new and ultimately highly controversial guidelines regarding mammography screening. So at that time, they rescinded their previous recommendation that women under the age of 50 should undergo routine screening mammography. That guideline had been in place since 2002. Now, this happened at a most inauspicious time because at that time, of course, we were engaged in a national debate on the Affordable Care Act. And at that time, folks who were opposed to that legislation pointed to this change in the guidelines as an example of the government's attempt to limit access to care, to restrict women's health care, and this became a hugely controversial guideline change. What is interesting, and your audience may not be aware of this, is that this was the second time, quite frankly, that mammography guidelines have collided with attempts at health care reform. In 1993, the National Cancer Institute dropped its guideline recommending screening mammography for women under the age of 50. And at that time, we were involved in debating and contemplating the Health Security Act, which at that time was derisively referred to as Hillary Care or Clinton Care. And we saw the same scenario play out. This was pointed to as an attempt to limit care, rationing of care, and so forth. And so mammography and politics have been intertwined for many decades, quite frankly. And when this event occurred in 2009, I thought it was a useful time for us to stop and kind of contemplate the whole journey that we've been on with this controversial test. In fact, next year, 2013, represents the 40th anniversary since mammography was officially rolled out on a national scale back in 1973.
But President Obama, isn't it true, came out against the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations?
Absolutely. In fact, shortly after the recommendations were publicized in November, in fact, within two or three days, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius came forward and basically said, forget about it. Just keep doing what you've been doing. We expect women over the age of 40 to continue having mammograms. And so when the official regs were written associated with the Affordable Care Act, they basically gave the new guidelines early retirement. So the new regulations say that we will no longer consider the 2009 U.S. Preventive Services guidelines as current, but we will rather, in their place, consider the 2002 guidelines, which state that women over the age of 40 should undergo routine annual screening mammography. So the guidelines were controversial, even though, in my opinion, they were quite reasonable and quite scientifically sound, but because they were politically untenable, they were basically shelved. And we've seen this time and time again. A very similar situation occurred in 1997, and we can get into that in just a minute. But politics has repeatedly trumped science in the arena of mammography guidelines.
Are you saying that there's no justification for women under 50 by scientific fact to have mammograms?
Well, what I am saying is this. So we know based on a number of large-scale trials that have been performed that women over the age of 40, at all ages, derive some benefit from screening mammography. And when I say benefit, I mean that a woman will reduce her likelihood of dying of breast cancer. However, the magnitude of that benefit increases with age. So a woman who's in her 50s will derive a greater benefit magnitude-wise than a woman in her 40s. And a woman in her 60s will derive a greater benefit as well. So the magnitude of that benefit increases with age. We also know that mammography has certain limitations or certain risks. And chief among them, we talk about in the book, are false positives or false alarms. And that means a woman is recalled for additional workup and biopsies. No cancer is found. False negatives, where the mammogram misses the cancer. And overdiagnosis, where screening finds cancers that would not become evident in the patient's lifetime. Some of these risks of screening are more common in younger women, especially false positives. So there is a risk-benefit calculus that goes into one's contemplation of undergoing screening or not. And that risk-benefit equation becomes more favorable to screening as women age. So yes, there is a benefit at all ages, but the risk-benefit ratio improves over time. And so my philosophy is that women should be given all the information, and rather than using the approach that we've used over the past few decades, which basically says, just have a mammogram, just do it, we should give women all the information on risks and benefits and allow and empower them to make their own choices. So, for example, some women may choose to begin screening at 40. Some may choose to begin screening at 50. Frankly, there are some women who, after being fully informed, may choose not to be screened at all. And I believe all of these decisions need to be respected.
Doctor, how about the risk of women under 30 having breast x-rays, and discuss mammograms versus MRI?
Right. So you're probably alluding to a study that was published just a few weeks ago, and that study looked specifically at women who are at exceedingly high risk of breast cancer, women who are genetically positive for the BRCA genes. And they found that in this very small population, and remember, we're talking about a very, very small piece of the overall population, maybe 1% or so, in these women, if they had mammograms or any other radiation exposure to their breasts under the age of 30, they saw an increase in the likelihood of breast cancer over their lifetime. And so these women who are particularly prone to breast cancer should certainly avoid mammography under the age of 30. Now, for average risk women, the amount of radiation they receive from a mammogram is very, very low and should not be a major barrier to undergoing screening. So let me give you some context for the benefit of the audience. As we walk around every day on planet Earth, we are all subjected to a certain amount of what's called background radiation. Now, much of this comes from outer space. It's called cosmic radiation. Depending on where you live, you may be exposed to radon gas. But a mammogram exposes a woman to about 7 weeks supply, 7 weeks worth of this background naturally occurring radiation. So it's a very small amount. We can look at it another way. There was an analysis published a few years ago where they found that if you look at 100,000 women who are screened with mammograms annually from 40 to 74, over that time period, there could possibly be 11 women who die of radiation-induced breast cancer. However, at the same time, there would be about 500 women whose lives would be saved through early detection of naturally occurring breast cancer. So, yes, there is a theoretical possibility that radiation could induce breast cancer. It is a very small risk, and some of the other risks of screening are probably more significant than the risk of radiation-induced cancer.
Would the same risk be involved in, say, dental x-rays?
The amount of radiation from a dental x-ray is extremely low, much, much lower than even a mammogram. But, of course, the effects of radiation are cumulative, so we all should strive to limit our exposure to, you know, medical radiation only when necessary. And so our physicians and we ourselves should have constant conversations about this issue, because there has been a dramatic rise in the amount of radiation that we all receive from medical x-rays over the past couple of decades. And so this is an issue for everyone, not just women, not just with respect to breast cancer.
But don't you feel that the possible harmful effects of radiation exposure are outweighed over tremendously by the benefits?
Oh, absolutely. And that was my point a minute ago, that in that group of 100,000 women who are screened from 40 to 74, it's possible that 11 of them could develop and die of breast cancer, but 500 of them would be saved through early detection
right.
of naturally occurring breast cancer. So I don't mean to suggest that the risk of radiation-causing breast cancer is a major, major risk. However, it is a risk that needs to be discussed. And one of my objections to the way we have promoted mammography over the past several decades is that we've used this just-do-it approach, where we've basically said, you know, mammography is beneficial and you should just do it. And we have not had this open, frank, complete discussion that is so important for patient education and consumer education. And part of the result of that is that many women harbor a variety of misconceptions about what a mammogram is, what a mammogram does.
Doctor, do you think that the huge NFL campaign that's been going on this month furthers that notion of just do it, with the players wearing pink shoes and sunglasses and armbands and the cheerleaders dressed in pink and such? Does that,
well,
that further that ideology?
It's good and bad. So we know that Breast Cancer Awareness Month started back in 1985, and its original purpose and its primary purpose even today is to encourage women to undergo mammograms, and that's fine. I am certainly not opposed to mammograms, and I am a breast radiologist. This is what I do. So it would be, you know, highly disingenuous of me to say I'm opposed to mammograms. I am not. What I am opposed to is the promotion of mammography that gives one-sided messages. And over the years, we've been afraid of muddling the message and confusing women. Those are terms, statements, and phrases that I've heard repeatedly in conferences and meetings and so forth. We need to keep the message simple, and the simple message is just do it. That is what I object to. I certainly don't object to having women have access to mammography. I believe access should always be there. I believe insurance should cover mammograms, but I believe women should be given all the information so that individual women can make their own choices.
We're speaking with Dr. Handel Reynolds on today's Topical Currents. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. We're going to take a short break. Also, when we return, we'll return with in-studio guest Dr. Roger Khoury. Stay with us.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. City Year Miami unites a diverse group of 17 to 24-year-olds for a year of service as tutors, mentors, and role models who make a difference to students and schools. You can learn more online at cityyear.org. City Year, give a year, change the world. Did you know that Medicare's annual election period now starts on October 15th? Soon it will be time to make important decisions about your coverage. The state's SHINE program can guide you through the enrollment period. Why not call SHINE today at 1-800-963-5337?
This month, President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney take part in the final presidential debate at Lynn University in Boca Raton. What are the issues that matter to you? We'll find out Friday, October 19th, when the Florida Roundup broadcasts live from Lynn University in advance of the debate. I'm Phil Latzman. Join me along with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin, and Florida lawmakers and top political journalists. Reserve your seat now for the Florida Roundup presidential debate special, Friday, October 19th at noon, and find out more at WLRN.org.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And And welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman along with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Dr. Handel Reynolds, author of The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Joining us shortly, Dr. Roger Khoury of the Miami Breast Center in South Florida. If you'd like to join in this conversation, if you have questions for either doctor, and the conversation will expand to breast reconstruction, our number is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email with your question at radio@WLRN.org. Dr. Reynolds, why do you think the American College of Radiology, which I assume you're a member of?
Yes.
And the National Cancer Society have always been in favor of screening under the age of 50.
So the American College of Radiology, and as you have rightly pointed out, I am a radiologist, and I am a member of the American College of Radiology. And so the College of Radiology and the American Cancer Society have been the most prominent and the most vocal proponents of screening mammography since its initial rollout in 1973. Both of these organizations adopted a pro position on the question of whether women under 50 should be screened back in the mid-1970s. And in fact, at that time, there was really no scientific evidence to justify that position. In the mid-1970s, the only study that had been done looking at whether mammography is useful or not is a study done in the 60s, the Health Insurance Plan of New York, and it showed that women between the ages of 50 and 59 could reduce their risk of dying of breast cancer by undergoing routine mammography. So the question is, why did these two prominent organizations adopt a position in favor of aggressive screening of women under 50 absent scientific evidence? And if you look back at some of the writings from the time and also reflections that have been written more recently by folks who were involved at the time, it's clear that there was a hope that if it worked in older women, it probably would work in younger women, and so younger women should be given the benefit of the doubt. So I believe it was out of a hope and certainly a desire that one day we would have solid evidence that it works in these younger women. That is why when these two organizations, when the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute rolled out the large nationwide demonstration program called the BCDDP in 1973, they recruited women as young as 35 to undergo routine screening mammography. It was based on that hope that one day this would be helpful for younger women. It turns out that within 3 years after this program started, in 1976, we were embroiled in the first major national debate on whether this is a good thing or not, and it has occurred repeatedly since that time.
We're speaking with Dr. Handel Reynolds of Piedmont Hospital. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Also joining us in studio is Dr. Roger Khoury. He heads the Miami Breast Center in South Florida. He's a plastic surgeon and an expert on post-mastectomy breast reconstruction. Dr. Roger Khoury, what's the latest technology as far as post-mastectomy breast reconstruction?
Well, classically, women who've lost their breast to cancer had two options, either an implant, foreign body insert in their breast, or a flap procedure, which involves microsurgery and usually intensive surgery with the risk of complication. We've introduced a third option. We regenerate the breast. We're able to grow back a scaffold, a matrix, and simply with a syringe and a cannula, re-inject fat in there, getting to grow and have them grow back their breast. It's minimally invasive. It's very safe, low risk, no incisions, no scars, no cutting. And the breast that they get back there is a sensate breast, feels the most natural, the most beautiful breast. I spent my career doing the flap microsurgery procedure. I was one of the pioneers doing that 20 years ago. And this is really a breakthrough because we're able to give women back their breast. They literally feel that their lost breast has grown back again.
What's the success rate for this procedure?
Well, that's the beauty here, is as compared to the flaps or the implant where you get all or none, failure or success, what we do here, we gradually build back a breast. It's a stepwise process. We don't do it all at once. And so, well, if you don't get to it in two steps, you get to it in three steps, and you stop when the woman is happy, when she feels that she got her breast back.
So how long does it, could you explain it for our listeners and tell us how long it does take to be effective generally?
It takes about 2 to 4 months to regenerate the breast if the woman is not radiated. Now, if the breast has received radiation, it's not as receptive to the fat graft, and it doesn't respond as well. Radiation kills a lot of things along with killing cancer cells. So we have to first overcome that radiation effect. And it takes about a year to grow back a breast if there's been radiation. If there's no radiation, we do it anywhere from 2 to 4, maximum 6 months, which is the time it usually takes to go through a mastectomy, implant, expander, implant exchange, classic reconstruction technique.
Now, pardon me, but where does this fat come from?
Well, that's been a woman's dream for centuries. Take the fat from here that you don't want and put it there. So there's a secondary benefit here of body sculpturing. We do liposuction, and we take any unwanted fat that deposits and turn it into the breast mound.
And what kind of liposuction is that?
We use a very gentle liposuction. It's done by hand with a low pressure and a fine cannula, because we're not doing liposuction to get rid of the fat. We're doing liposuction to harvest the seeds. These are the seeds that are going to be basically take soil again in the new matrix, the scaffold that's created by this device. It's a very important device that allows us to do this. It's called the Brava. It's a suction cup kind of a device, which is worn like a bra, and it creates the envelope. It creates the recipient matrix, fertilizes, increases the blood vessel, grows back the nerves. That's what makes it sensate. And once, it's basically all edema, and then we fill this with the liposuction fat.
So how long after a woman has lost her breast can the procedure begin?
Well, I'd like to start at the time of the mastectomy. That's the best, because there we have the opportunity to put quite a bit of fat in the muscle that's exposed rather at the end of the mastectomy operation. So I do a lot of these in combination with the general surgeon. And the best patient for this are the women who are at risk for breast cancer. So where we're doing prophylactic mastectomies, two at the same time, and the woman wakes back from her wakes up from a mastectomy, and she still has a breast, a small breast, but she has a breast mount. She doesn't have the concave chest defect, and from there on, we just expand this a month later and graft a second time, and they could get a B cup with one more session after that, and if they want to be larger and they have more fat to spare, we go for the C cup. For third session.
Dr. Handel Reynolds, do you have any comment on this procedure, techniques?
Not any specific comments about the techniques, but it's very gratifying that over the past years, plastic surgeons have developed better and better techniques to assist women who have had a mastectomy. Because one of the curious things we've noted is that there is a trend, and we don't know exactly why that is, but there is a trend here lately of women opting for mastectomy as their primary breast cancer surgery as opposed to lumpectomy. We're certainly seeing that more frequently in our breast center than I saw it, say, 15 years ago. And I believe part of that is probably twofold. One is the pervasive underlying fear that, this may come back. Just cut it off. Just get rid of it. And the other, I believe, is we have better and better reconstructive techniques that can replace the breast as just was noted, and so patients are less hesitant to undergo a mastectomy. So I applaud my plastic surgery colleagues for developing these fabulous techniques.
Dr. Reynolds, you devoted a lot of time in your book discussing DCIS, or ductal carcinoma in situ.
Yes.
Or what you call, or what is called, stage zero breast cancer.
Yes.
Can you please explain what this is?
Sure. So for the benefit of the audience, ductal carcinoma in situ, otherwise known as DCIS or stage zero breast cancer, is a stage in the evolution of breast cancer where the cancer cells are completely within the milk ducts. So there's no lump, there is no generally no pain, there are no signs or symptoms. Now, prior to mammography, prior to the early 1970s, DCIS constituted about 1 or 2% of all breast cancers. Now, 30 to 40 years later, it constitutes anywhere from 20 to 25, maybe even 30% of all breast cancers. And the reason for that is simple. DCIS is very easily diagnosed on mammography. In fact, mammography is almost tailor-made to find DCIS. On a mammogram, this condition shows up as little tiny white specks. We call those microcalcifications, and we see them frequently. So the net effect is that screening for breast cancer with mammography results in a huge increase in the number of women diagnosed with this condition, about 50,000 women per year in this country. Now, what on earth could possibly be wrong with that? And in general, you know, there's probably nothing wrong with finding really early breast cancer except this. We don't really understand DCIS very well, and we believe that probably no more than about a third to a half of these really, really early breast cancer lesions would go on to progress to the more dangerous form that we call invasive breast cancer. Now, a DCIS that remains DCIS forever is non-lethal. It can't kill. So only about a third to a half, we believe, would ever progress if left alone. The problem is, with current technology, we are unable to separate the ones that will progress from the ones that will not progress. And so, essentially, all women who are diagnosed with DCIS today undergo some kind of treatment, whether it's a lumpectomy and radiation, or we are seeing an increase in the number of women opting for mastectomy after a DCIS diagnosis. This is what is often referred to as overdiagnosis, or the finding of cancers that, absent screening, may never have become evident in the person's lifetime. So what is really needed is a variety of things, but we clearly need more research resources devoted to understanding DCIS so that we can better figure out which ones need to be treated and which ones don't. Because as long as we're screening for breast cancer with mammography, we will find a lot of DCIS. That is a given. So what we need to do is refine our approach to DCIS, figure out which ones really need to be treated, which ones do not need to be treated, so that we do not over-treat large numbers of women.
But at present, because we don't have those means,
correct.
Everybody who is
everybody
diagnosed gets treatment.
That's correct.
And you agree that they should, do you?
And they should, because there is really no way to predict, you know, which ones will progress and which ones will not. So absolutely, they should be treated. But you know, these things can occur on at the same time. We can, on the one hand, say women should be treated if they are diagnosed with DCIS. We can also, at the same time, stand up and say, hey, guys, we really need to work on this so that, you know, 10, 15 years from now, we're not saying the same thing. We're not still falling back on this, you know, this crutch that, oh, we don't know how to separate them. We need to rapidly get to the point where we can sort out DCIS so that women are not overtreated.
We're discussing mammograms and breast reconstruction on today's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break and be back with more and take your calls.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. For the past 2 weeks, WLRN's Kenny Malone and the Miami Herald's Patrick Farrell have been traveling our swing state to capture the voices of the powerful Florida voter. Join them Wednesday at 6 p.m. at Books and Books in Coral Gables as they discuss their dispatches from the swing state, and follow their journey online at WLRN.org. The disease of addiction doesn't discriminate based on age or status. Comprehensive addiction treatment and recovery offered for older adults and baby boomers at Hanley Center. 855-718-2233. Hanley Center. Recovery for life.
Cami Music presents the first ever concert of the Moscow Stratensky Monastery Choir in Florida with a program of rare Russian sacred chants, popular folk songs, and 20th century romances. Having performed at the Vatican and Notre Dame de Paris, the choir is coming to the Adrian Arsht Center on Wednesday, October 17th at 8 p.m. The New York Times describes their sound as a luminous blend characteristic of Russian choral tradition. Tickets at arshtcenter.org. Parker Playhouse presents Divorce Party, the musical. Described as a hilarious journey to hell and back from the producers of Menopause, the musical, it's the ultimate girls' night out. Divorce Party, the refreshing new musical that celebrates starting over, getting stronger, and finding humor even in one of life's worst events. At Parker Playhouse, November 27th through December 9th. Tickets at parkerplayhouse.com or 954-462-0222.
And And it's Topical Currents. We are back on this Tuesday edition. Bonnie Berman along with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Dr. Handel Reynolds of Piedmont Hospital. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Also joining us in the studios, Dr. Roger Khoury. He heads the Miami Breast Center in South Florida and has a new method for reconstructing breasts. If you want to join in this conversation, ask a question to either doctor or tell of your own experience, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email radio@WLRN.org. That's radio@WLRN.org.
And we have a caller who's called in at 1-800-743-WLRN. First up, this is Marianne in Fort Lauderdale. Thanks for your patience, Marianne. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I just want to share my perspective. I was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 47. I had no risk factors, thin, healthy, no genes, not in the family. And so had my cancer been found on a mammogram, it would have helped me. But the other thing I want to say is that my cancer was not found on a mammogram, and I'm very distressed at all the emphasis on mammograms. I had a 2.5-centimeter cancer. I'd had breast implants 20 years before, and it was growing along the top of the implant, and I religiously had mammograms every year, and my plastic surgeon, you know, insisted that I did, and it was found because the plastic surgeon was changing out these 20-year-old implants, and he found strange tissue, which turned out to be this 2.5-centimeter cancer. So, you know, number one, you can get it in your 40s, and number two, you know, I thought I was okay because I had mammograms. The cancer came back 2 years later, and I'm now stage four, and I've been living stage four for several years. But I get really upset every year at this Susan Komen thing, go get mammograms, and the fact that it lulls us into a false sense of, you know, we're going to be okay if we have a mammogram, and it turns out to miss it.
That's one of the points in Dr. Reynolds' book. Dr. Reynolds, you want to comment?
Yeah, that certainly is one of the points of the book, and I just want to say all the best to the caller in her journey. But we have promoted mammography, and we've talked about mammography using very simplistic, very one-sided messages. And as I said earlier, the prevailing message has always been, just do it. If you have a mammogram, that's what you need to do. It's a silver bullet. It's the best thing you can do to protect yourself. Mammography has limitations. Screening for cancer, any cancer with any test, has certain limitations, certain harms, and certain risks. And mammography has three principal harms. Number one, false positives or false alarms. False negatives, as the caller just discussed, where the mammogram frankly misses the cancer, and overdiagnosis that we've talked about briefly before. Specifically to the caller's issue about breast implants, this is a major concern for anyone who reads mammograms. And again, we have very, very rarely talked about it in public. A breast implant is an opaque object. So if you look at a mammogram in a woman who has implants, you basically see a big white object in the center of the breast. The breast tissue oftentimes is very white as well. Breast cancer shows up as a white object. And so, you know, we have three different kinds of white objects within a white background, and it's very, very difficult to pick out the cancer. Furthermore, the cancer oftentimes will hide behind the implant. So this is a limitation of mammography that we very rarely discuss. You know, we can certainly in a minute get a little deeper into the issue of dense breast tissue and what can be done if you have dense breast tissue, but that's the other part of the question that the caller raised.
Dr. Roger Khoury, your thoughts on this, and tell us more about the techniques that you use.
Well, the techniques counteract the implants that are radiopaque and foreign bodies and flaps that involve more surgery and cutting. This technique involves no incision, no cutting, no new scars, and you get a benefit of liposuction.
But if a woman has had implants, how does that affect?
Well, obviously, women has had, we remove the implant and we replace it with their own fat. That's one of the most common procedures I end up doing, is replacing implants with her own fat. And fat is radiolucent, which is transparent to the x-ray, so actually it improves the visibility and removes that white object that Dr. Handel was talking about.
Is this procedure covered by insurance?
For breast reconstruction, it is.
Yes.
So if you've had a mastectomy.
If you had a mastectomy, obviously we're doing a breast reconstruction. As a matter of fact, this technique is more friendly to the entire system because it's less costly than the big operations involved in breast reconstruction, and it doesn't have all the long-term problem that you carry around when you have an implant that needs replacement, rupture, calcifications problem, etc. So it is a less safer, more cheaper in the long-term procedure. The patient stops when she's happy. We gradually grow back a breast. This is in situ tissue engineering. We're actually engineering a breast, and hundreds of women so far have a benefit from it. We actually have a book that's just coming out this week about it called Your Natural Breast, and it's all there featured at our website, MiamiBreastCenter.com.
Okay.
Let's move along to a caller. This is Adrian in Miami. Hi.
Hello. My name is Adrian. I'm a surgical oncologist, and I would like to have an answer from Dr. Roger Courier first. What's the incidence of fat necrosis? And it's actually only fat, or is it actually ductal tissue that gets reconstructed? And for your radiologist, I would like to ask his opinion about the MRI as a replacement or a substitute for mammograms.
Well, we're not regrafting ductal tissue. Obviously, we're just grafting fat. So we're regenerating a breast mound that consists only fat. No breast tissue that may cause a problem. And the incidence of fat necrosis actually is very small. We have about a 15% incidence in our last study. Fat necrosis means the fat hasn't survived and died. And it all depends on how much fat you put in. If you put in more than the tissue can tolerate, if you graft beyond the capacity of the tissue, you're going to get some necrosis. And that's the reason why people have been doing flaps and big operations, because in a mastectomy defect, you have very little room to put a lot of fat. What our breakthrough here is we are enlarging that space with a device called Brava. It creates a scaffold, creates the envelope, makes room for much more fat so that we can graft more without reaching that level of fat necrosis and calcification.
Okay. And Dr. Reynolds, the other part of the question concerning MRI versus...
Yeah, and that's a great question. And what I'd like to do is just kind of circle back to something I mentioned earlier about dense breast tissue, because this, I think, is an appropriate time to discuss MRI and other ancillary technologies.
Right.
So just to educate your audience on this, when you look at a mammogram, you see a combination of white tissue and dark gray tissue. And that white tissue is what we call dense tissue or fibrous tissue. And the gray tissue is fatty tissue. And every woman's mammogram has a combination of the two. Generally speaking, younger women have denser breasts, more white tissue. Older women have more fatty breasts. And it should be pointed out right here that you really can't predict the amount of dense tissue based on the texture of the breast itself. So this is a determination that is made with a mammogram, not necessarily by just feeling the breast, because you can certainly be fooled. Now, women who have dense breasts have two primary problems. Number one, they have a higher likelihood of developing breast cancer, about 5 times the risk of developing breast cancer as compared to a woman who has fatty breasts. The second principal problem is that dense breast tissue hides breast cancer, because breast cancer shows up as a white object, and if you put a white object in a white background, you don't see it. So we miss large numbers of breast cancer in women who have dense breast tissue. This is an issue we've not discussed over the years. However, your audience may be aware that there is a growing movement now across this country. So far, we have 5 states, New York, Texas, Connecticut, California, and Virginia, where state laws have been passed all in the past couple of years or so that require mammography facilities to notify women who have dense breasts. And if they are notified that they have dense breasts, they are also to be told that mammography is limited, and furthermore, they may want to consider other screening options to add to mammography, not to replace it, but to add to it. Now, the most commonly added supplemental screening tests are ultrasound and MRI. So let's talk about ultrasound briefly, because that's done more frequently. Ultrasound uses sound waves. There's no radiation. It's the same kind of test we use to look at pregnant women. And it gets around the dense tissue because it uses a totally different technology. So that is one additional test a woman could have after a mammogram to look for cancer. Now, what is the likelihood that that's going to do her any good?
Well, just like everything else, you know, it's a mixed bag. So if you look at 1,000 women who've had normal mammograms and they have dense tissue, so they all went in for their mammogram, they all got a piece of paper saying they were normal, and you did ultrasound on all 1,000 of those women, you would find 5 cancers on average that you didn't know existed because they all got a piece of paper saying their mammogram was normal. Now, to find those 5 cancers, you would recommend a biopsy to about 50 women. So what's the point of that? The point is that ultrasound will find additional cancers, yes, but at the same time, there are lots of false positives. So many women will be advised to have biopsy of things that show up on ultrasound that ultimately turn out to be nothing. So it's a mixed bag. There is no free lunch. Yes, you can find more cancers, but you also increase your likelihood of undergoing an unnecessary biopsy. Likewise with MRI, except that MRI now, we have to deal with the issue of cost, because an MRI is extremely expensive compared to ultrasound and mammography. And so, again, you can find additional cancers. Again, there are false positives or false alarms, but now we have the issue of it being, you know, $1,000 instead of, you know, a couple of hundred dollars. So these are the issues with the supplemental screening. But, again, this is the conversation patients need to have with their doctors. You know, if you have dense breast tissue, talk it over with your doctor. Do you want to stop with the mammogram, or do you want to go on for possible other supplemental screening?
It sounds like those with dense breast tissue should go on with supplemental screening. We need to take another short break on our program today. Dr. Reynolds, Dr. Curry, stay with us. It's Topical Currents, and we'll return in a moment.
We'll be back to Topical Currents right here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR News Station. Nobody likes sitting in traffic, but you can help Miami-Dade County do something about it. Blocking an intersection causes major gridlock, and it's not only frustrating, it's illegal, and you could get fired. Or you could get fined. So do your part to keep traffic moving. Keep intersections clear. Don't block the box. Details at miamidade.gov/MOVN. Celebrities create an aura of excitement around the 27th annual Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, featuring premieres of top new independent films and world cinema, trendy parties, and gatherings. October 19th through November 11th. Details and tickets at FLIFF.com.
This month, President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney take part in the final presidential debate at Lynn University in Boca Raton. What are the issues that matter to you? We'll find out Friday, October 19th, when the Florida Roundup broadcasts live from Lynn University in advance of the debate. I'm Phil Latzman. Join me along with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin, and Florida lawmakers and top political journalists. Reserve your seat now for the Florida Roundup presidential debate special, Friday, October 19th at noon, and find out more at WLRN.org.
Belen Jesuit Preparatory School kicks off the second season of its cultural series with a performance by 3-time Grammy-nominated Cuban music group Tiempo Libre on Saturday, October 27th at the Roca Theater at 8 p.m. Net proceeds from the cultural series to benefit the Belen Jesuit Scholarship Program. Details at belenjesuit.org.
And we return 49 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman and Dr. Handel Reynolds and Dr. Roger Khoury. Dr. Khoury, how about quickly contact information for the Miami Breast Center?
MiamiBreastCenter.com on the web.
Very good.
You get a lot of information there.
And Dr. Handel Reynolds, how about a website people can learn more about you and the book?
Yes, themammogramdilemma.com.
And we'll take a quick call. We've got, line 6. This is Katie in Key Biscayne. We're getting close to the end of the program, Katie. Please be brief if you could.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've been told by my homeopath that to have a mammogram after 60 is dangerous in the sense that we all carry dormant cancer cells in our breasts, and by the very sort of pressure squish, you know, we undergo with the mammogram, that could activate the cancer cells. Is this true?
Dr. Reynolds, briefly?
That's one of the more common urban myths that we encounter every day. Not a week goes by that I don't address that question from a patient of mine. There's really no scientific evidence that would suggest that the compression associated with mammography will cause or activate cancer or anything like that. So mammography is uncomfortable for most women. The compression is not comfortable, and it's easy to say, my God, it hurts so bad it must cause cancer. We certainly hear that every day, but there's really no science behind that.
Dr. Reynolds, I was kind of surprised at this quote when you say overdiagnosis and mammography are inextricably linked. Apart from the effect in reducing breast cancer mortality, overdiagnosis has been screening mammography's most consequential legacy, end quote. How can you separate it from how it has reduced breast cancer mortality?
I think the point I'm trying to make is that you really can't. As long as we screen with mammography, and we don't have any other effective screening tools right now, so this is it. We're left with basically improving upon current technology, and there have been improvements made. But as long as we're screening with mammography, we will absolutely find large numbers of DCIS, to go back to our earlier discussion, and many of those cases represent overdiagnosis. So the two are inextricably linked. As long as we're screening with this tool, we will also produce overdiagnosis, and so we need to focus on refining our approach to DCIS, and maybe even, as I mentioned in the book, our approach to reading mammograms so that we can possibly dial back the number of DCIS cases that are routinely identified in a mammogram.
In your opinion, should women under the age of 50 get mammograms?
In my opinion, the more appropriate approach to whether a woman has a mammogram or not is informed decision-making. So my hope with this book is that women will be educated on this issue, will be informed, and ultimately empowered to make these decisions. I fully support insurance mandates for mammography starting at the age of 40. Okay. I 100% support that. It should be there for the foreseeable future. But I believe individual women should be empowered to make those choices for themselves in consultation with their doctor.
I see.
So, but genetically, if you have a mother or sisters who have had developed breast cancer, you should be extra careful, I suppose.
Yeah, of course. And clearly, everything we've talked about today, or most of it, applies to women at average risk. If you are at high risk, certainly if you are gene positive, you absolutely should be undergoing multi-layered screening. In fact, the American Cancer Society recommends that for those women, they should undergo mammography and MRI on an annual basis. If you have a first-degree relative, but you're not gene positive, your mother or your sister, you are at elevated risk. And so, what you do about that will be different from a woman who has no risk factors. And what I am saying is that these are individual decisions that individual women should be encouraged and helped to make on an individual basis.
Let's take another quick call. This is Valerie in Miami. Please be brief, Valerie. Hi.
Sure. I just wanted to know, I was going by the guidelines in 2009, and I agreed with them, but when I saw my OB-GYN and the radiologist this year, they both said they wanted continual annual mammograms because women in their 40s, when they do get cancer, it's more aggressive than older women. I just wanted their opinion on that.
Sure, and I think what your doctors were referring to is the fact that the growth rate of breast cancer is variable. So a breast cancer may grow faster in a younger woman than in an older woman in her 70s or 80s. So that is, in fact, true, that the growth rate is variable. Recognize also that we do have lots of different guidelines out there. So the American College of Radiology, you spoke about your radiologist, does recommend annual screening for women 40 to 49. The American Cancer Society does as well. The USPSTF does not. So depending on who you speak to, you may get a different answer. But the fact is we've done numerous studies on women of all ages, and we found that, as I said earlier, there is a benefit for women in their 40s. It's not as great as women in their 50s or in their 60s or 70s, and some of the harms of screening may be more common in younger women. So there's a risk-benefit ratio that becomes more favorable as women age.
Doctor,
and I'm certainly appreciative of the fact that your doctors want you to have it.
Dr. Roger Corey, we're very short on time. Tell us, I understand you have a new book that's on the way.
Well, we just published this book, Your Natural Breasts, A Better Way to Augment, Reconstruct, and Correct using your own fat. And it's a breakthrough. We're tissue engineering a breast after mastectomy, or improving defects, congenital malformation, or implant malformation. I see a lot of implant malformation.
And they can get information at your website, I suppose.
They can see it at MiamiBreastCenter.com, yes. It's a really breakthrough. Patients get a new breast again. The breast has feeling, and they get there without any incision.
Well, I certainly want to thank both doctors, and also thank Bonnie Berman. Joining us from Atlanta, or he joined us from Atlanta, Dr. Handel Reynolds of Piedmont Hospital. His book is called The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. And also joining us was Dr. Roger Khoury, head of the Miami Breast Center here in South Florida. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for a very informative hour.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to today's Topical Currents. Our producers, Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page for author and book links, discussion, in-studio photos, and more. And we have free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our new website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program addresses language intelligence with Dr. Joseph Rome. He gives lessons on persuasion and the art of simple but effective rhetoric. And to the calendar, all literary today. On this day in 1854, 158 years ago, the birth of Oscar Wilde in Dublin. The consummate wit, playwright, poet, and glittering conversationalist. He died in 1900, destitute, aged 46. The Importance of Being Earnest, a picture of Dorian Gray. And on this day in 1888, 124 years ago, the birth of Nobel Prize winner Eugene O'Neill in a Broadway hotel room. The building now houses Starbucks. The Emperor Jones, Behind the Horizons, and of course, The Iceman Cometh. And one more on this day in 1927, 85 years ago, the birth of German Nobel Prize winner Günter Grass in Danzig. The Tin Drum, Cat and Mouse, Dog Years, all dealt with the rise of Nazism. His Nobel came in 1999. And we leave with a thought from Oscar Wilde, who died of cerebral meningitis. Quote, "Always forgive your enemies. Nothing annoys them so much." This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.3.